people's sleep may not be disturbed. They kept him out in the unwholesome mists at night, and ordered him back into his harness in the day. But he was not persuaded, no. Taken out of harness one day at noon to feed, if he could find food, he sobbed 12 times, once for every stroke of the bell, and died on her bosom. Nothing human could have held life in the boy but his determination to tell all his wrong. He forced back the gathering shadows of death as he forced his clenched right hand to remain clenched and to cover his wound. Then, with that man's permission and even with his aid, his brother took her away. In spite of what I know, she must have told his brother, and what that is will not be long unknown to you, Doctor, if it is now. His brother took her away, for his pleasure and diversion, for a little while. I saw her pass me on the road. When I took the tidings home, our father's heart burst. He never spoke one of the words that filled it. I took my young sister, for I have another, to a place beyond the reach of this man, and where at least she will never be his vassal. Then I tracked the brother here, and last night climbed in, a common dog but sword in hand. Where is the loft window? It was somewhere here. The room was darkening to his sight. The world was narrowing around him. I glanced about me and saw that the hay and straw were trampled over the floor as if there had been a struggle. She heard me and ran in. I told her not to come near us till he was dead. He came in and first tossed me some pieces of money, then struck at me with a whip. But I, though a common dog, so struck at him as to make him draw. Let him break into as many pieces as he will, the sword that he stained with my common blood. He drew to defend himself, thrust at me, with all his skill for his life. My glance had fallen but a few moments before on the fragments of a broken sword lying among the hay. That weapon was a gentleman's. In another place lay an old sword that seemed to have been a soldier's. Now lift me up, Doctor. Where is he? He's not here, I said, supporting the boy and thinking that he referred to the brother. He, proud as these nobles are, he's afraid to see me. Where is the man who was here? Turn my face to him. I did so, raising the boy's head against my knee. But invested for the moment with extraordinary power, he raised himself completely, obliging me to rise too, or I could not have still supported him. "Marquis," said the boy, turned to him with his eyes wide open and his right hand raised. "In the days when all these things are to be answered for, I summon you and yours to the last of your bad race to answer for them. I mark this cross of blood upon you as a sign that I do it. In the days when all these things are to be answered for, I summon your brother, the worst of the bad race, to answer for them separately. I mark this cross of blood upon him as a sign that I do it." Twice he put his hand to the wound in his breast, and with his forefinger drew a cross in the air. He stood for an instant with the finger yet raised, and as it dropped, he dropped with it, and I lay him down dead. When I returned to the bedside of the young woman, I found her raving in precisely the same order of continuity. I knew that this might last for many hours, and that it would probably end in the silence of the grave. I repeated the medicines I had given her, and I sat at the side of the bed until the night was far advanced. She never abated the piercing quality of her shrieks, never stumbled in the distinctness or the order of her words. They were always my husband, my father, and my brother. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Hush! This lasted 26 hours from the time when I first saw her. I had come and gone twice, and was again sitting by her when she began to falter. I did what little could be done to assist that opportunity, and by she sank into a lethargy, and lay like the dead. It was as if the wind and rain had lulled at last, after a long and fearful storm. I released her arms, and called the woman to assist me to compose her figure and the dress she had torn. It was then that I knew her condition to be that of one in whom the first expectations of being a mother have arisen, and it was then that I lost the little hope I had had of her. Is she dead? Asked the Marquis, whom I will still describe as the elder brother, coming booted into the room from his horse. Not dead, said I, but like to die. What strength there is in these common bodies, he said, looking down at her with some curiosity. There is prodigious strength, I answered him, in sorrow and despair. He first laughed at my words and then frowned at them. He moved a chair with his foot near to mine, ordered the woman away, and said in a subdued voice, Doctor, finding my brother in this difficulty with these hinds, I recommended that your aid should be invited. Your reputation is high, and as a young man with your fortune to make, you are probably mindful of your interest. The things that you see here are things to be seen and not spoken of. I listened to the patient's breathing and avoided answering. Do you honour me with your attention, doctor? Monsieur, said I, in my profession the communications of patients are always received in confidence. I was guarded in my answer, for I was troubled in my mind with what I had heard and seen. Her breathing was so difficult to trace that I carefully tried the pulse and the heart. There was life and no more. Looking round as I resumed my seat, I found both the brothers intent upon me. I write with so much difficulty. The cold is so severe. I'm so fearful of being detected and consigned to an underground cell and total darkness that I must abridge this narrative. There is no confusion or failure in my memory. It can recall and could detail every word that was ever spoken between me and those brothers. She lingered for a week. Towards the last, I could understand some few syllables that she said to me by placing my ear close to her lips. She asked me where she was, and I told her. Who I was, and I told her. It was in vain that I asked her for her family name. She faintly shook her head upon the pillow, and kept her secret, as the boy had done. I had no opportunity of asking her any question until I had told the brothers she was sinking fast and could not live another day. Until then, though no one was ever presented to her consciousness save the woman and myself, one or other of them had always jealously sat behind the curtain at the head of the bed when I was there. But when it came to that, they seemed careless what communication I might hold with her, as if the thought passed through my mind. I were dying, too. I always observed that their pride bitterly resented the younger brothers, as I call him, having crossed swords with a peasant, and that peasant a boy. The only consideration that appeared to affect the mind of either of them was the consideration that this was highly degrading to the family and was ridiculous. As often as I caught the younger brother's eyes, their expression reminded me that he disliked me deeply for knowing what I knew from the boy. He was smoother and more polite to me than the elder. But I saw this. I also saw that I was an encumbrance in the mind of the elder, too. My patient died 2 hours before midnight, at a time by my watch answering almost to the minute when I had first seen her. I was alone with her when her forlorn young head drooped gently on one side, and all her earthly wrongs and sorrows ended. The brothers were waiting in a room downstairs, impatient to ride away. I had heard them alone at the bedside, striking their boots with their riding whips and loitering up and down. "At last she is dead," said the elder, when I went in. "She is dead," said I. "I congratulate you, my brother," were his words as he turned round. He had before offered me money, which I had postponed taking. He now gave me a rouleau of gold. I took it from his hand, but laid it on the table. I had considered the question, and had resolved to accept nothing. "Pray excuse me," said I. "Under the circumstances, no." They exchanged looks, but bent their heads to me as I bent mine to them, and we parted without another word on either side. "I am weary. Weary, weary, worn down by misery. I cannot read what I have written with this gaunt hand." Early in the morning, the rouleau of gold was left at my door in a little box with my name on the outside. From the first, I had anxiously considered what I ought to do. I decided that day to write privately to the minister, stating the nature of the two cases to which I had been summoned, and the place to which I had gone, in effect, stating all the circumstances. I knew what court influence was, and what the immunities of the nobles were, and I expected that the matter would never be heard of. But I wished to relieve my own mind. I had kept the matter a profound secret, even from my wife, and this, too, I resolved to state in my letter. I had no apprehension whatever of my real danger, but I was conscious that there might be danger for others, if others were compromised by possessing the knowledge that I possessed. I was much engaged that day, and could not complete my letter that night. I rose long before my usual time next morning to finish it. It was the last day of the year. The letter was lying before me, just completed, when I was told that a lady waited who wished to see me. I am growing more and more unequal to the task I have set myself. It is so cold, so dark, my senses are so benumbed, and the gloom upon me is so dreadful. The lady was young, engaging, and handsome, but not marked for long life. She was in great agitation. She presented herself to me as the wife of the Marquis Saint-Evremond. I connected the title by which the boy had addressed the elder brother with the initial letter embroidered on the scarf, and had no difficulty in arriving at the conclusion that I had seen that nobleman very lately. My memory is still accurate, but I cannot write the words of our conversation. I suspect that I am watched more closely than I was, and I know not at what times I may be watched. She had in part suspected and in part discovered the main facts of the cruel story, of her husband's share in it, and my being resorted to. She did not know that the girl was dead. Her hope had been, she said in great distress, to show her, in secret, a woman's sympathy. Her hope had been to avert the wrath of heaven from a house that had long been hateful to the suffering many. She had reasons for believing that there was a young sister living, and her greatest desire was to help that sister. I could tell her nothing but that there was such a sister. Beyond that, I knew nothing. Her inducement to come to me, relying on my confidence, had been the hope that I could tell her the name and place of abode, whereas to this wretched hour I am ignorant of both. These scraps of paper fail me. One was taken from me, with a warning, yesterday. I must finish my record today. She was a good, compassionate lady, and not happy in her marriage. How could she be? The brother distrusted and disliked her, and his influence was all opposed to her. She stood in dread of him, and in dread of her husband, too. When I handed her down to the door, there was a child, a pretty boy from 2 to 3 years old, in her carriage. "For his sake, doctor," she said, pointing to him in tears, "I would do all I can to make what poor amends I can. He will never prosper in his inheritance otherwise. I have a presentiment that if no other innocent atonement is made for this, it will one day be required of him. What I have left to call my own, it is little beyond the worth of a few jewels, I will make it the first charge of his life to bestow, with the compassion and lamenting of his dead mother on this injured family, if the sister can be discovered." She kissed the boy, and said, caressing him, "It is for thine own dear sake. Thou wilt be faithful, little Charles?" The child answered her bravely, "Yes." I kissed her hand, and she took him in her arms and went away, caressing him. I never saw her more. As she had mentioned her husband's name in the faith that I knew it, I added no mention of it to my letter. I sealed my letter, and not trusting it out of my own hands, delivered it myself that day. That night, the last night of the year, towards 9 o'clock, a man in a black dress rang at my gate, demanded to see me, and softly followed my servant, Ernest Defarge, a youth, upstairs. When my servant came into the room where I sat with my wife, oh, my wife, beloved of my heart, my fair young English wife, we saw the man who was supposed to be at the gate, standing silent behind him. "An urgent case in the Rue Saint-Honoré," he said. It would not detain me. He had a coach in waiting. It brought me here. It brought me to my grave. When I was clear of the house, a black muffler was drawn tightly over my mouth from behind, and my arms were pinioned. The two brothers crossed the road from a dark corner and identified me with a single gesture. The Marquis took from his pocket the letter I had written, showed it to me, burnt it in the light of a lantern that was held, and extinguished the ashes with his foot. Not a word was spoken. I was brought here. I was brought to my living grave. If it had pleased God to put it in the hard heart of either of the brothers, in all these frightful years, to grant me any tidings of my dearest wife, so much as to let me know by a word whether alive or dead, I might have thought that he had not quite abandoned them. But now I believe that the mark of the Red Cross is fatal to them, and that they have no part in his mercies. And them and their descendants, to the last of the race, I, Alexandre Manette, unhappy prisoner, do this last night of the year, 1767, in my unbearable agony, denounce to the times when all these things shall be answered for. I denounce them to heaven and earth. A terrible sound arose when the reading of this document was done, a sound of craving and eagerness that had nothing articulate in it but blood. The narrative called up the most revengeful passions of the time, and there was not a head in the nation but must have dropped before it. Little need in presence of that tribunal and that auditory to show how the Defarges had not made the paper public with the other captured Bastille memorials borne in procession, and had kept it, biding their time. Little need to show that this detested family name had long been anathematized by Saint Antoine, and was wrought into the fatal register. The man never trod ground, whose virtues and services would have sustained him in that place, that day, against such denunciation. And all the worse for the doomed man, that the denouncer was a well-known citizen, his own attached friend, the father of his wife. One of the frenzied aspirations of the populace was for imitations of the questionable public virtues of antiquity, and for sacrifices and self-immolations on the people's altar. Therefore, when the president said, else had his own head quivered on his shoulders, that the good physician of the Republic would deserve better still of the Republic by rooting out an obnoxious family of aristocrats, and would doubtless feel a sacred glow and joy in making his daughter a widow and her child an orphan, there was wild excitement, patriotic fervour, not a touch of human sympathy. "Much influence around him, has that doctor?" murmured Madame Defarge, smiling to the vengeance. "Save him now, my doctor. Save him." At every juryman's vote there was a roar. Another and another, roar and roar, unanimously voted, at heart and by descent an aristocrat, an enemy of the Republic, a notorious oppressor of the people, back to the conciergerie, and death within 24 hours. Chapter 11. Dusk. The wretched wife of the innocent man thus doomed to die fell under the sentence as if she had been mortally stricken. But she uttered no sound, and so strong was the voice within her, representing that it was she of all the world who must uphold him in his misery, and not augment it, that it quickly raised her, even from that shock. The judges having to take part in a public demonstration out of doors, the tribunal adjourned. The quick noise and movement of the courts emptying itself by many passages had not ceased, when Lucy stood stretching out her arms towards her husband, with nothing in her face but love and consolation. "If I might touch him, if I might embrace him once! Oh, good citizens, if you would have so much compassion for us!" There was but a jailer left, along with two of the four men who had taken him last night, and Barsad. The people had all poured out to the show in the streets. Barsad proposed to the rest, "Let her embrace him, then. It is but a moment." It was silently acquiesced in, and they passed her over the seats in the hall to a raised place, where he, by leaning over the dock, could fold her in his arms. "Farewell, dear darling of my soul. My parting blessing on my love. We shall meet again, where the weary are at rest." They were her husband's words, as he held her to his bosom. "I can bear it, dear Charles. I am supported from above. Don't suffer for me. A parting blessing for our child. I send it to her by you. I kiss her by you. I say farewell to her by you. My husband, no. A moment." He was tearing himself apart from her. "We shall not be separated long. I feel that this will break my heart by and by, but I will do my duty while I can, and when I leave her, God will raise up friends for her, as he did for me." Her father had followed her, and would have fallen on his knees to both of them, but that Darnay put out a hand and seized him, crying, "No, no! What have you done? What have you done that you should kneel to us? We know now what a struggle you made of old. We know now what you underwent when you suspected my descent and when you knew it. We now know the natural antipathy you strove against and conquered for her dear sake. We thank you with all our hearts and all our love and duty. Heaven be with you." Her father's only answer was to draw his hands through his white hair and wring them with a shriek of anguish. "It could not be otherwise," said the prisoner. "All things have worked together as they have fallen out. It was the always vain endeavour to discharge my poor mother's trust that first brought my fatal presence near you. Good could never come of such evil. A happier end was not in nature to so unhappy a beginning. Be comforted and forgive me. Heaven bless you." As he was drawn away, his wife released him and stood looking after him with her hands touching one another in the attitude of prayer, and with a radiant look upon her face in which there was even a comforting smile. As he went out at the prisoner's door, she turned, laid her head lovingly on her father's breast, tried to speak to him, and fell at his feet. Then, issuing from the obscure corner from which he had never moved, Sidney Carton came and took her up. Only her father and Mr. Lorry were with her. His arm trembled as it raised her and supported her head. Yet there was an air about him that was not at all of pity, that had a flush of pride in it. "Shall I take her to a coach? I shall never feel her weight." He carried her lightly to the door and laid her tenderly down in a coach. Her father and their old friend got into it, and he took his seat beside the driver. When they arrived at the gateway, where he had paused in the dark, not many hours before, to picture to himself on which of the rough stones of the street her feet had trodden, he lifted her again, and carried her up the staircase to their rooms. There he laid her down on a couch, where her child and Miss Pross wept over her. "Don't recall her to herself," he said, softly, to the latter. "She is better so. Don't revive her to consciousness while she only faints." "Oh, Carton, Carton, dear Carton," cried little Lucy, springing up and throwing her arms passionately round him in a burst of grief. "Now that you have come, I think you will do something to help Mama, something to save Papa. Oh, look at her, dear Carton. Can you, of all the people who love her, bear to see her so?" He bent over the child and laid her blooming cheek against his face. He put her gently from him, and looked at her unconscious mother. "Before I go," he said, and paused, "I may kiss her?" It was remembered afterwards that when he bent down and touched her face with his lips, he murmured some words. The child, who was nearest to him, told them afterwards, and told her grandchildren, when she was a handsome old lady, that she heard him say, "A life you love." When he had gone out into the next room, he turned suddenly on Mr. Lorry and her father, who were following, and said to the latter, "You had great influence but yesterday, Dr. Manette. Let it at least be tried. These judges, and all the men in power, are very friendly to you, and very recognizant of your services, are they not?" "Nothing connected with Charles was concealed from me. I had the strongest assurances that I should save him. And I did. He returned the answer in great trouble, and very slowly. "Try them again. The hours between this and tomorrow afternoon are few and short. But try. I intend to try. I will not rest a moment."
"That's well. I have known such energy as yours do great things before now, though never," he added with a smile and a sigh together,
"such great things as this. But try. Of little worth as life is when we misuse it, it is worth that effort. It would cost nothing to lay down if it were not."
"I will go," said Dr. Manette, "to the prosecutor and the president straight, and I will go to others whom it is better not to name. I will write, too, and... But stay. There is a celebration in the streets, and no one will be accessible until dark."
"That's true. Well, it is a forlorn hope at the best, and not much the forlorner for being delayed till dark. I should like to know how you speed, though.
Mind, I expect nothing.
When are you likely to have seen these dread powers, Dr. Manette?"
"Immediately after dark, I should hope. Within an hour or two from this."
"It'll be dark soon after four. Let us stretch the hour or two. If I go to Mr. Lorry's at 9, shall I hear what you have done, either from our friend or from yourself?"
"Yes. May you prosper."
Mr. Lorry followed Sidney to the outer door, and touching him on the shoulder as he was going away, caused him to turn.
"I have no hope,"
said Mr. Lorry, in a low and sorrowful whisper.
"Nor have I. If any one of these men, or all of these men, were disposed to spare him, which is a large supposition, for what is his life or any man's to them, I doubt if they durst spare him after the demonstration in the court. And so do I. I heard the fall of the axe in that sound."
Mr. Lorry leaned his arm upon the doorpost and bowed his face upon it.
"Don't despond," said Carton, very gently. "Don't grieve. I encouraged Dr. Manette in this idea because I felt that it might one day be consolatory to her. Otherwise she might think his life was wont only thrown away or wasted, and that might trouble her."
"Yes, yes, yes," returned Mr. Lorry, drying his eyes. "You are right. But he will perish. There is no real hope.
Yes, he will perish. There is no real hope," echoed Carton, and walked with a settled step downstairs.
Chapter 12. Darkness. Sidney Carton paused in the street, not quite decided where to go.
"Tellson's banking house at 9, he said, with a musing face. "Shall I do well in the meantime to show myself?"
"I think so.
It is best that these people should know there is such a man as I here. It is a sound precaution, and may be a necessary preparation. But care, care, care. Let me think it out."
Checking his steps, which had begun to tend towards an object, he took a turn or two in the already darkening street, and traced the thought in his mind to its possible consequences. His first impression was confirmed.
"It is best," he said, finally resolved, "that these people should know there is such a man as I here."
And he turned his face towards Saint-Antoine.
Defarge had described himself that day as the keeper of a wine shop in the Saint-Antoine suburb. It was not difficult for one who knew the city well to find his house without asking any question. Having ascertained its situation, Carton came out of those closer streets again, and dined at a place of refreshment, and fell sound asleep after dinner. For the first time in many years, he had no strong drink. Since last night he had taken nothing but a little light thin wine, and last night he had dropped the brandy slowly down on Mr. Lorry's half, like a man who had done with it. It was as late as 7 o'clock when he awoke refreshed, and went out into the streets again. As he passed along towards Saint-Antoine, he stopped at a shop window where there was a mirror, and slightly altered the disordered arrangement of his loose cravat, and his coat collar, and his wild hair. This done, he went on direct to Defarge's, and went in.
There happened to be no customer in the shop but Jacques Three, of the restless fingers and the croaking voice. This man, whom he had seen upon the jury, stood drinking at the little counter, in conversation with the Defarges, man and wife. The Vengeance assisted in the conversation, like a regular member of the establishment. As Carton walked in, took his seat, and asked, in very indifferent French, for a small measure of wine, Madame Defarge cast a careless glance at him, and then a keener, and then a keener, and then advanced to him herself, and asked him what it was he had ordered. He repeated what he had already said. "English?" asked Madame Defarge, inquisitively raising her dark eyebrows. After looking at her as if the sound of even a single French word was slow to express itself to him, he answered in his former strong foreign accent, "Yes, madame, yes, I am English." Madame Defarge returned to her counter to get the wine, and as he took up a Jacobin journal and feigned to pore over it, puzzling out its meaning, he heard her say, "I swear to you, like Evremonde." Defarge brought him the wine and gave him good evening.
"How?"
"Good evening." "Oh, good evening, citizen," filling his glass.
"Ah, and good wine. I drink to the Republic."
Defarge went back to the counter and said, "Certainly, a little like." Madame sternly retorted, "I tell you, a good deal like." Jacques Three pacifically remarked,
"He is so much in your mind, see you, madame."
The amiable Vengeance added with a laugh,
"Yes, my faith, and you are looking forward with so much pleasure to seeing him once more tomorrow."
Carton followed the lines and words of his paper with a slow forefinger and with a studious and absorbed face. They were all leaning their arms on the counter close together, speaking low. After a silence of a few moments, during which they all looked towards him without disturbing his outward attention from the Jacobin editor, they resumed their conversation.
"It is true what Madame says," observed Jacques Three. "Why stop? There is great force in that. Why stop?"
"Well, well," reasoned Defarge, "one must stop somewhere. After all, the question is still where."
"An extermination," said Madame.
"Magnificent,"
croaked Jacques Three. The Vengeance also highly approved. "Extermination is good doctrine, my wife," said Defarge, rather troubled. "In general, I say nothing against it. But this doctor has suffered much. You've seen him today. You've observed his face when the paper was read."
"I have observed his face," repeated Madame contemptuously and angrily. "Yes, I have observed his face. I have observed his face to be not the face of a true friend of the Republic. Let him take care of his face."
"And you have observed, my wife," said Defarge, in a deprecatory manner, "the anguish of his daughter, which must be a dreadful anguish to him."
"I have observed his daughter," repeated Madame. "Yes, I have observed his daughter more times than one. I have observed her today, and I have observed her other days. I have observed her in the court, and I have observed her in the street by the prison. Let me but lift my finger."
She seemed to raise it. The listener's eyes were always on his paper, and to let it fall with a rattle on the ledge before her, as if the axe had dropped.
"The citizeness is superb," croaked the juryman.
"She is an angel," said the Vengeance, and embraced her.
"As to thee," pursued Madame, implacably addressing her husband, "if it depended on thee, which happily it does not, thou wouldst rescue this man, even now." "No," protested Defarge, "not if to lift the glass would do it. But I would leave the matter there. I say, stop there." "See you then, Jacques," said Madame Defarge, wrathfully. "And see you too, my little Vengeance. See you both. Listen. For other crimes as tyrants and oppressors, I have this race a long time on my register, doomed to destruction and determination. Ask my husband. Is that so?
It is so, assented Defarge, without being asked. In the beginning of the great days, when the Bastille falls, he finds this paper of today, and he brings it home, and in the middle of the night, when this place is clear and shut, we read it. Here on this spot, by the light of this lamp, ask him, is that so?
It is so, assented Defarge. That night I tell him, when the paper is read through and the lamp is burnt out, and the day is gleaming in above those shutters and between those iron bars, that I have now a secret to communicate. Ask him, is that so?
It is so, assented Defarge again.
I communicate to him that secret. I smite this bosom with these two hands as I smite it now, and I tell him, Defarge, I was brought up among the fishermen of the seashore, and that peasant family, so injured by the two Evremonde brothers, as that Bastille paper describes, is my family. Defarge, that sister of the mortally wounded boy upon the ground, was my sister. That husband was my sister's husband. That unborn child was their child. That brother was my brother. That father was my father. Those dead are my dead. And that summons to answer for those things descends to me. Ask him, is that so?
It is so, assented Defarge once more.
Then tell wind and fire where to stop, returned Madame. But don't tell me.
Both her hearers derived a horrible enjoyment from the deadly nature of her wrath. The listener could feel how white she was without seeing her, and both highly commended it. Defarge, a weak minority, interposed a few words for the memory of the compassionate wife of the Marquis, but only elicited from his own wife a repetition of her last reply.
Tell the wind and the fire where to stop, not me.
Customers entered, and the group was broken up. The English customer paid for what he had had, perplexedly counted his change, and asked, as a stranger, to be directed towards the National Palace. Madame Defarge took him to the door and put her arm on his, in pointing out the road. The English customer was not without his reflections, then, that it might be a good deed to seize that arm, lift it, and strike under it, sharp and deep. But he went his way, and was soon swallowed up in the shadow of the prison wall. At the appointed hour, he emerged from it to present himself in Mr. Lorry's room again, where he found the old gentleman walking to and fro in restless anxiety. He said he had been with Lucy until just now, and had only left her for a few minutes to come and keep his appointment. Her father had not been seen since he quitted the banking-house towards 4 o'clock. She had some faint hopes that his mediation might save Charles, but they were very slight. He had been more than 5 hours gone. Where could he be? Mr. Lorry waited until 10. But Dr. Manette not returning, and he being unwilling to leave Lucy any longer, it was arranged that he should go back to her and come to the banking-house again at midnight. In the meanwhile, Carton would wait alone by the fire for the doctor. He waited and waited, and the clock struck 12, but Dr. Manette did not come back. Mr. Lorry returned and found no tidings of him, and brought none. Where could he be? They were discussing this question and were almost building up some weak structure of hope on his prolonged absence when they heard him on the stairs. The instant he entered the room, it was plain that all was lost. Whether he had really been to anyone, or whether he had been all that time traversing the streets, was never known. As he stood staring at them, they asked him no question, for his face told them everything.
"I cannot find it," said he. "And I must have it. Where is it?"
His head and throat were bare, and as he spoke, with a helpless look straying all around, he took his coat off and let it drop on the floor.
"Where is my bench? I've been looking everywhere for my bench, and I can't find it. What have they done with my work? Time presses. I must finish those shoes."
They looked at one another, and their hearts died within them.
"Come, come," said he, in a whimpering, miserable way. "Let me get to work. Give me my work."
Receiving no answer, he tore his hair and beat his feet upon the ground like a distracted child.
"Don't torture a poor forlorn wretch," he implored them with a dreadful cry, "but give me my work. What is to become of us?
if those shoes are not done tonight. Lost. Utterly lost.
It was so clearly beyond hope to reason with him, or to try to restore him, that as if by agreement they each put a hand upon his shoulder, and soothed him to sit down before the fire, with a promise that he should have his work presently. He sank into the chair, and brooded over the embers, and shed tears. As if all that had happened since the garret time were a momentary fancy or a dream, Mr. Lorry saw him shrink into the exact figure that Defarge had had in keeping. Affected and impressed with terror as they both were by this spectacle of ruin, it was not a time to yield to such emotions. His lonely daughter, bereft of her final hope and reliance, appealed to them both too strongly. Again, as if by agreement, they looked at one another with one meaning in their faces. Carton was the first to speak.
"The last chance is gone. There was not much. Yes, he had better be taken to her. But before you go, will you for a moment steadily attend to me? Don't ask me why I make the stipulations I'm going to make and exact the promise I'm going to exact. I have a reason. A good one. I do not doubt it," answered Mr. Lorry. "Say on."
The figure in the chair between them was all the time monotonously rocking itself to and fro and moaning. They spoke in such a tone as they would have used if they had been watching by a sickbed in the night. Carton stooped to pick up the coat, which lay almost entangling his feet. As he did so, a small case in which the doctor was accustomed to carry the lists of his day's duties fell lightly on the floor. Carton took it up, and there was a folded paper in it. "We should look at this," he said. Mr. Lorry nodded his consent. He opened it and exclaimed,
"Thank God!"
"What is it?" asked Mr. Lorry, eagerly. "A moment. Let me speak of it in its place. First," he put his hand in his coat and took another paper from it, "that is the certificate which enables me to pass out of this city. Look at it. You see? Sidney Carton, an Englishman." Mr. Lorry held it open in his hand, gazing in his earnest face. "Keep it for me until tomorrow. I shall see him tomorrow, you remember, and I'd better not take it into the prison." "Why not?" "I don't know. I prefer not to do so. Now take this paper that Dr. Manette has carried about him. It is a similar certificate, enabling him and his daughter and her child at any time to pass the barrier and the frontier, you see?" "Yes. Pepsi obtained it as his last and utmost precaution against evil yesterday. When is it dated? But no matter. Don't stay to look. Put it up carefully with mine and your own. Now observe. I never doubted until within this hour or two that he had or could have such a paper. It is good until recalled. But it may be soon recalled, and I have reason to think will be. They are not in danger. They are in great danger. They are in danger of denunciation by Madame Defarge. I know it from her own lips. I have overheard words of that woman's tonight which have presented their danger to me in strong colours. I have lost no time, and since then I have seen the spy. He confirms me. He knows that a wood sawyer living by the prison wall is under the control of the Defarges, and has been rehearsed by Madame Defarge as to his having seen her," he never mentioned Lucy's name, "making signs and signals to prisoners. It is easy to foresee that the pretense will be the common one, a prison plot, and that it will involve her life, and perhaps her child's, and perhaps her father's, for both have been seen with her at that place. Don't look so horrified. You will save them all. Heaven grant I may, Carton, but how? I'm going to tell you how. It will depend on you, and it could depend on no better man. This new denunciation will certainly not take place until after tomorrow, probably not until 2 or 3 days afterwards, more probably a week afterwards. You know it is a capital crime to mourn for or sympathize with the victim of the guillotine. She and her father would unquestionably be guilty of this crime. This woman, the inveteracy of whose pursuit cannot be described, would wait to add that strength to her case and make herself doubly sure. You follow me? So attentively, and with so much confidence in what you say, that for the moment I lose sight," touching the back of the doctor's chair, "even of this distress. You have money, and can buy the means of travelling to the sea coast as quickly as the journey can be made.
Your preparations have been completed for some days to return to England. Early tomorrow, have your horses ready, so that they may be in starting trim at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It shall be done.
His manner was so fervent and inspiring that Mr. Lorry caught the flame and was as quick as youth.
You are a noble heart. Did I say we could depend upon no better man? Tell her tonight what you know of her danger as involving her child and her father. Dwell upon that. She would lay her own fair head beside her husband's, cheerfully.
He faltered for an instant, then went on as before. For the sake of her child and her father, press upon her the necessity of leaving Paris with them and you at that hour. Tell her that it was her husband's last arrangement. Tell her that more depends upon it than she dare believe or hope. You think that her father, even in this sad state, will submit himself to her, do you not?
I am sure of it.
I thought so.
Quietly and steadily have all these arrangements made in the courtyard here, even to the taking of your own seat in the carriage. The moment I come to you, take me in and drive away. I understand that I wait for you under all circumstances. You have my certificate in your hand with the rest, you know, and will reserve my place. Wait for nothing but to have my place occupied and then for England.
Why then, said Mr. Lorry, grasping his eager but so firm and steady hand, it does not all depend on one old man, but I shall have a young and ardent man at my side.
By the help of heaven, you shall. Promise me solemnly that nothing will influence you to alter the course on which we now stand pledged to one another.
Nothing, Carton. Remember these words tomorrow. Change the course, or delay in it for any reason, and no life can possibly be saved. And many lives must inevitably be sacrificed. I will remember them. I hope to do my part faithfully. And I hope to do mine. Now, goodbye.
Though he said it with a grave smile of earnestness, and though he even put the old man's hand to his lips, he did not part from him then. He helped him so far to arouse the rocking figure before the dying embers as to get a cloak and hat put upon it, and to tempt it forth to find where the bench and work were hidden that it still moaningly besought to have. He walked on the other side of it and protected it to the courtyard of the house where the afflicted heart, so happy in the memorable time when he had revealed his own desolate heart to it, outwatched the awful night.
He entered the courtyard and remained there for a few moments alone, looking up at the light in the window of her room. Before he went away, he breathed a blessing towards it, and a farewell.
Chapter 13 52 In the black prison of the Conciergerie, the doomed of the day awaited their fate. They were in number as the weeks of the year. 52 were to roll that afternoon on the life-tide of the city to the boundless everlasting sea. Before their cells were quit of them, new occupants were appointed. Before their blood ran into the blood spilled yesterday, the blood that was to mingle with theirs tomorrow was already set apart. 72 were told off. From the farmer general of 70, whose riches could not buy his life, to the sempstress of 20, whose poverty and obscurity could not save her. Physical diseases, engendered in the vices and neglects of men, will seize on victims of all degrees, and the frightful moral disorder, born of unspeakable suffering, intolerable oppression, and heartless indifference, smote equally without distinction. Charles Darnay, alone in a cell, had sustained himself with no flattering delusion since he came to it from the tribunal. In every line of the narrative he had heard his condemnation. He had fully comprehended that no personal influence could possibly save him, that he was virtually sentenced by the millions, and that units could avail him nothing. Nevertheless, it was not easy, with the face of his beloved wife fresh before him, to compose his mind to what it must bear. His hold on life was strong, and it was very, very hard to loosen. By gradual efforts and degrees, unclosed a little here, it clenched the tighter there. And when he brought his strength to bear on that hand, and it yielded, this was closed again. There was a hurry
too, in all his thoughts, a turbulent and heated working of his heart that contended against resignation. If for a moment he did feel resigned, then his wife and child, who had to live after him, seemed to protest and to make it a selfish thing. But all this was at first. Before long, the consideration that there was no disgrace in the fate he must meet, and that numbers went the same road wrongfully and trod it firmly every day, sprang up to stimulate him. Next followed the thought that much of the future peace of mind enjoyable by the dear ones depended on his quiet fortitude. So by degrees he calmed into the better state, when he could raise his thoughts much higher and draw comfort down. Before it had set in dark on the night of his condemnation, he had travelled thus far on his last way. Being allowed to purchase the means of writing and a light, he sat down to write until such time as the prison lamp should be extinguished. He wrote a long letter to Lucy, showing her that he had known nothing of her father's imprisonment until he had heard of it from herself, and that he had been as ignorant as she of his father's and uncle's responsibility for that misery until the paper had been read. He had already explained to her that his concealment from herself of the name he had relinquished was the one condition, fully intelligible now, that her father had attached to their betrothal, and was the one promise he had still exacted on the morning of their marriage. He entreated her, for her father's sake, never to seek to know whether her father had become oblivious of the existence of the paper, or had had it recalled to him, for the moment, or for good, by the story of the tower on that old Sunday under the dear old plane tree in the garden. If he had preserved any definite remembrance of it, there could be no doubt that he had supposed it destroyed with the Bastille, when he had found no mention of it among the relics of prisoners which the populace had discovered there, and which had been described to all the world. He besought her, though he added that he knew it was needless, to console her father by impressing him through every tender means she could think of with the truth that he had done nothing for which he could justly reproach himself, but had uniformly forgotten himself for their joint sakes. Next to her preservation of his own last grateful love and blessing, and her overcoming of her sorrow to devote herself to their dear child, he adjured her, as they would meet in heaven, to comfort her father. To her father himself, he wrote in the same strain, but he told her father that he expressly confided his wife and child to his care. And he told him this very strongly, with the hope of rousing him from any despondency or dangerous retrospect towards which he foresaw he might be tending. To Mr. Lorry he commended them all, and explained his worldly affairs. That done, with many added sentences of grateful friendship and warm attachment, all was done. He never thought of Carton. His mind was so full of the others that he never once thought of him. He had time to finish these letters before the lights were put out. When he lay down on his straw bed, he thought he had done with this world. But it beckoned him back in his sleep and showed itself in shining forms. Free and happy, back in the old house in Soho, though it had nothing in it like the real house, unaccountably released and light of heart, he was with Lucy again, and she told him it was all a dream, and he had never gone away. A pause of forgetfulness, and then he had even suffered, and had come back to her, dead and at peace, and yet there was no difference in him. Another pause of oblivion, and he awoke in the sombre morning, unconscious where he was or what had happened, until it flashed upon his mind, "This is the day of my death." Thus had he come through the hours to the day when the 52 heads were to fall. And now, while he was composed and hoped that he could meet the end with quiet heroism, a new action began in his waking thoughts, which was very difficult to master. He had never seen the instrument that was to terminate his life. How high it was from the ground, how many steps it had, where he would be stood, how he would be touched, whether the touching hands would be dyed red, which way his face would be turned, whether he would be the first or might be the last. These and many similar questions, in no wise directed by his will, obtruded themselves over and over again, countless times. Neither were they connected with fear. He was conscious of no fear. Rather, they originated in a strange, besetting desire to know what to do when the time came. A desire gigantically disproportionate to the few swift moments to which it referred. A wondering that was more like the wondering of some other spirit within his than his own. The hours went on as he walked to and fro, and the clocks struck the numbers he would never hear again. 9, gone forever. 10, gone forever. 11, gone forever. 12, coming on to pass away. After a hard contest with that eccentric action of thought which had last perplexed him, he had got the better of it. He walked up and down, softly repeating their names to himself. The worst of the strife was over. He could walk up and down, free from distracting fancies, praying for himself and for them. 12. Gone forever. He had been apprised that the final hour was 3, and he knew he would be summoned some time earlier, inasmuch as the tumbrils jolted heavily and slowly through the streets. Therefore he resolved to keep 2 before his mind as the hour, and so to strengthen himself in the interval that he might be able, after that time, to strengthen others. Walking regularly to and fro with his arms folded on his breast, a very different man from the prisoner who had walked to and fro at La Force, he heard 1 struck away from him, without surprise. The hour had measured like most other hours. Devoutly thankful to heaven for his recovered self-possession, he thought, "There is but another now," and turned to walk again. Footsteps in the stone passage outside the door. He stopped. The key was put in the lock and turned. Before the door was opened, or as it opened, a man said in a low voice, in English, "He has never seen me here. I've kept out of his way. Go you in alone. I wait near. Lose no time." The door was quickly opened and closed, and there stood before him, face to face, quiet, intent upon him, with the light of a smile on his features and a cautionary finger on his lip, Sidney Carton. There was something so bright and remarkable in his look that for the first moment the prisoner misdoubted him to be an apparition of his own imagining. But he spoke, and it was his voice. He took the prisoner's hand, and it was his real grasp. "Of all the people upon earth, you least expected to see me?" he said. "I could not believe it to be you. I can scarcely believe it now. You are not—" The apprehension came suddenly into his mind. "A prisoner? No, I am accidentally possessed of a power over one of the keepers here, and in virtue of it I stand before you. I come from her, your wife, dear Darnay." The prisoner wrung his hand. "I bring you a request from her." "What is it?" "A most earnest, pressing, and emphatic entreaty, addressed to you in the most pathetic tones of the voice so dear to you that you well remember." The prisoner turned his face partly aside. "You have no time to ask me why I bring it, or what it means. I have no time to tell you. You must comply with it. Take off those boots you wear, and draw on these of mine." There was a chair against the wall of the cell, behind the prisoner. Carton, pressing forward, had already, with the speed of lightning, got him down into it, and stood over him, barefoot. "Draw on these boots of mine. Put your hands to them. Put your will to them. Quick!" "Carton, there is no escaping from this place. It never can be done. You will only die with me. It is madness. It would be madness if I asked you to escape. But do I? When I ask you to pass out at that door, tell me it is madness and remain here. Change that cravat for this of mine. That coat for this of mine. While you do it, let me take this ribbon from your hair and shake out your hair, like this of mine." With wonderful quickness, and with a strength both of will and action that appeared quite supernatural, he forced all these changes upon him. The prisoner was like a young child in his hands. "Carton, dear Carton, it is madness. It cannot be accomplished. It never can be done. It has been attempted and has always failed. I implore you not to add your death to the bitterness of mine." "Do I ask you, my dear Darnay, to pass the door? When I ask that, refuse. There are pen and ink and paper on this table. Is your hand steady enough to write?" "It was, when you came in." "Steady it again, and write what I shall dictate. Quick, friend, quick!" Pressing his hand to his bewildered head, Darnay sat down at the table. Carton, with his right hand in his breast, stood close beside him. "Write exactly as I speak."
To whom do I address it? To no one. Carton still had his hand in his breast.